Hello and welcome to this week's episode of the Mad Tech Podcast. My name is Lindsay Roundtree. I am head of content at ExchangeWire. And to our regular listeners, I would like to apologise for our brief hiatus last week. The entire team were in Paris, but you'll be delighted to hear that we're back now. I also want to take this opportunity to shout out to an unsung hero of the Mad Tech Podcast. His name is Rodney Lewis, he is responsible for all of our EMEA videos, podcasts. He is our videographer, he is our producer, our editor, our sound recorder, and he's so dedicated that last week he came to our office waiting to record the podcast. It didn't happen, and we forgot to tell him we were all in Paris. So apologies publicly to Rodney.
Sorry, Rodders.
And as I said, unsung hero of ExchangeWire's audiovisual content.
And congratulations on Spurs winning during the week. Thank you. Go on to Spurs.
And then moving on to the football chat. But onto the podcast, I would like to take this opportunity to welcome our wonderful guest, Anna Forbes, who is UK General Manager of the Trade Desk. Welcome, Anna.
Thank you very much for having me.
Lovely to have you here. And of course, we've got the curmudgeon that sits in the corner and rants, otherwise known as Kieran O'Kane, our CEO.
Hello.
Hi. How are you doing?
I'm fantastic.
You in a good mood?
I am. I feel good today. Tired last week, obviously.
You're tired. Yeah.
ATS Paris was a rousing success. So
it was. It was excellent. Yeah. Very exciting. Yeah.
Yeah.
On to ATS Madrid.
Yes. Upwards and onwards. ATS after ATS.
Absolutely. Anyway, let's kick it off. On to the news. So first of all, I would like to discuss the fact that IBM is offloading its marketing cloud assets. So it plans to sell its marketing software and e-commerce platform to private equity firm Centerbridge. Now, in almost every article I've read, Centerbridge has been named something completely different. Some have called it Cambridge, some have called it Centerpoint, but I'd like to confirm that it is actually Centerbridge. Centerbridge are going to take these assets and spin them off into a kind of a separate entity, the name of which hasn't been confirmed yet. And, you know, everyone's wondering what IBM's moves are. They did a similar move, made a similar offload move last year. But they also have made some big acquisitions too, like Red Hat in October. It's confirmed at this stage they will not be getting rid of Watson Ads, which is obviously formerly the Weather Channel. But it does beg the question, kind of, what are they up to? Are they realising that the kind of the marketing cloud arena that is so well covered and serviced by the likes of Oracle, Salesforce and Adobe is not an area they can compete in, and they're going after more of the kind of the back end play, the infrastructure play? What are people's thoughts on this?
Yeah, I mean, I think they definitely realise that there are some big players out there, and ultimately, you know, you've got to have a vision, and I think their vision is right to go more towards the infrastructure side. That's their bread and butter. That's their history, where they've come from. And really doubling down in that space makes a lot of sense. Not going after these really new, very innovative, you know, you think about Salesforce in particular, great business, very hard to compete with. They've just really come out of nowhere and own a whole category now.
And is this a bit like Accenture going into media buying, where they have a lot of clients in one area? Those clients go, you know what, you'd be great at this. IBM were doing so well in the infrastructure play, everyone was going, come and join us in the marketing cloud sector as well. Then when push comes to shove, actually it's a lot tougher to get into that industry than they probably first thought.
I mean, I think that their competitive set, when we think about their competitive set in MarTech, the big MarTech platforms like Adobe, Salesforce, Oracle, they have very sticky sort of scaled technology propositions with the brands, right? So you could argue that Adobe builds its strength from its creative suite, Salesforce from CRM, and Oracle with its legacy database business. And IBM just had lots of legacy bits and pieces in there. I'm not saying that it's terrible, because actually some of the assets are pretty decent and they'll probably get a good home somewhere. A PE firm has just taken over. They've got a great track record in this industry, obviously. Some of them have and some of them haven't. We'll talk about that later. But maybe IBM has realised that they can't do everything. So they've invested quite a lot of money in the infrastructure side. So lots of AI-related stuff. They're big on machine learning, cloud computing. This is edge computing. This is and obviously, you know, they've just bought Red Hat. So, you know, they're big, and there's a big play on the infrastructure operating system layer as well. So you can't sort of operate in all those things. So they're probably hedging their bets and saying, this is going to require a lot of investment with probably not as much margin as I would get from a pure tech play, right? So they probably made the right decision, but what it means for the knock on an ad tech is probably one less buyer in the market. So, you know, I heard rumors that, a certain DSP was almost banking on them being acquired by I won't name the company, but you could probably guess it. It's a US-based company.
I'm going to guess it's not the Trade Desk.
No, it's not the Trade Desk.
Ah, right, okay.
The Trade Desk is too expensive. Yeah. I don't think anybody can buy the Trade Desk these days. But, except for Netflix. I just think IBM's made a calculated decision and probably the right decision for its shareholders and the company as a whole.
And what do you think this means for kind of their consultancy arm, their digital transformation arm, IBM iX, they're moving out of the cloud sector?
I mean, those... No offense to Accenture, I just don't understand those businesses. They just seem to be kind of like really...
Consultancies.
Yeah, like they just seem to be very fluffy and very consultative-led. I'm not sure. Does IBM really have... It'd be interesting to see what happens, because obviously they're probably leaning on those internal products to build a specific sort of consultancy layer on top of that. So who knows what could happen with that organization. Maybe it's making a lot of money. We don't know. I don't know the ins and outs.
There's no reason why that can't continue to spin off as its own independent arm without the need of the technology to back it, right?
Yeah, I agree. And I think that they're, you know, every industry is going through digital transformation. And if businesses have got, you know, no muscle internally to deal with that kind of rapid change, then using consultants to help guide them through that is the right thing to do. Because if you don't adapt to the new world, the new technology-led industry that you may reside in, you're going to die. So I absolutely think that they have a place where you don't have that ability, that capability internally to go do that. But, you know, there's different consultancy firms and different, and it depends on who works on your business, even within those consultancy firms. So,
It's also, you know, I'd say IBM are a company to make big bets, right? And if they were to make a big bet in the MarTech place, they would have to spend a lot of money acquiring and updating the product suites they have, right? So if you look at their competitive set before, you could argue Salesforce and Adobe are out in front, right? They're the companies really leading the MarTech. I would argue that Oracle really lean heavily on their email business, and the rest of their business is in trouble, right? So the ODC business is sort of shaking a little bit with the ad diss and all the rest of it.
Yeah, which and is what IBM got rid of.
Who knows what could happen post Google ITP? Maybe that ODC business is not going to work.
I think the Grapeshot acquisition was
it was smart, but they have to build on that. But if you ask me, the two out now sort of leaders in that space are Adobe and Salesforce. In my view, you know, like Adobe's made some really interesting buys around ad tech and martech. You know, they bought Magento there last year for a couple of billion. That was a smart move. It's a tough space. I mean, you know, MarTech is quite convoluted and quite crowded. And there will be, I mean, I think that business as a standalone could be quite interesting, because it won't be under the pressures that of IBM's, you know, shareholders. Why isn't that making the kind of margin you're making in your cloud business or your AI business? So as a standalone, it could actually do pretty well, because there's still room for some of those assets. But IBM, was probably a calculated assessment of the opportunity and said, we're better taking our resource and putting it into this because we can grow that business. And I think it's smart.
But I mean, so you talked about Oracle and ODC, Oracle Data Cloud, and you know, there's a lot of talk around the convergence of ad tech and martech. And actually, if you look at ODC versus Oracle proper, if you like, the Oracle Marketing Cloud, they are two completely separate entities. Mm. And while they all exist under the Oracle umbrella, are they not proof in and of themselves that AdSec and MarSec actually aren't really converging at all? Are they even getting further apart from each other? And is IBM offloading their marketing cloud more evidence of that, that actually there is not the convergence happening that we are hoping or expecting there to?
I think there is still a convergence happening, and it's led by data. MarTech typically are the giant operators in the space, and layering on ad tech businesses within their portfolio allows them to leverage data for their clients further and make it work harder. So I think there is still a convergence. It then really depends on how good a particular business that might have acquired ad tech businesses, how well they're integrating those businesses and leveraging that
there's still a tech. Big gap though between the transactional nature of ad tech and the SaaS, predominantly SaaS model in marketing. True. It's that's the hardest thing to square with the CFOs of those companies as they consider an acquisition, because how do you value that, and then how does that add the value of the company? So typically, you know, a company like Oracle would buy a SaaS business which adds more value to their stock price. Whereas if you add an ad tech company, it's like, we all know it's all based on it's seasonal in many ways, like, you know, Christmas, Valentine's, whatever. It's transactional. Like, it's not like every month we know we're going to get 10 million spend. It's not, it doesn't work that way. So I think that's the big chasm. It's not a case, I agree, about the data piece sort of connecting the layers, the execution layers, right? Because it's all about execution and management and activation of data. But it's all also about the business model. And the SaaS model still isn't predominant in Atlantic. No. And never will be, in my view.
Well, no, I guess not. I guess we, with each passing day, we've been moving further and further away from that model, right, in ad tech specifically.
That's
the,
okay.
The whole point of it. Anyway, I'm going to move on.
Okay.
It ties in. It's been a great chat. I'm loving it so far. It ties in nicely to the convergence of ad tech and martech and digital transformation in general. Lastminute.com, the very well-known online travel aggregator, have announced that they are launching their own in-housing consultancy. Mm. They've seen such great success from their own in-housing efforts over the past few years that they've decided to share their wisdom with other big brands. So this also ties in with the fact, it's quite complicated, I'm going to explain this. So they already have a kind of an in-house media and planning and buying arm called Travel People.
Yeah.
And they've launched this new in-housing consultancy called Playbook. They are now going to come together under a new brand within the lastminute.com group called Forward, that is going to be led by Alessandra Di Lorenzo, I think is the current chief customer officer of Last Minute. She will be CEO of Forward. Now, frankly, I've got to say, hello, conflict of interest. This to me seems quite bizarre, frankly. Yeah. I sort of wonder if lastminute.com should not focus just on getting their own business right rather than kind of going into sort of the media buying and planning and consulting arm. But it is very interesting. And they're not just consulting to travel brands, they're consulting to FMCGs. So I've got a lot of questions here, but let's start on kind of, do we agree this is a conflict of interest or is this not slightly weird? No?
I think it's
just for the record, I actually connected to Alessandra yesterday and invited her onto this podcast. So hello, Alessandra, I hope you're listening. First of all, it's very meta, isn't it? Like it's an in-house launches an in-housing solution to help other brands in-house. It's a bit... Are we reaching peak in-housing at this stage? It just feels all a bit like jumping the shark. You know that episode of Happy Days where Fonzie jumps over a shark and the whole...
Literally Happy
Days. That's where the phrase came. Happy Days went to shit after that. Basically.
I see.
I wonder if this is one of those moments. It just feels a bit weird. It just all feels a bit odd. I was sitting going, what? I mean, okay, there's definitely capabilities within that company because they said, we've seen the value of this. We could help other brands. But we were discussing what type of brands would they work with. We certainly couldn't work with their peers like Booking.com and all the rest of it, right? So it'll be smaller brands.
The scrappier challenger is travel brands.
Is it the Criteo travel brands they're helping with this?
The Criteo generation.
Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, it is interesting and I can't see how this would work in another category if you... Can you imagine like a large CPG brand that might have in-housed or a telcos that's in-housed and then go, we're actually really good at this. We're going to now do something that's completely divorced from our mission and our goals as a business, which is to be the best CPG or telcos company that we can. But we're now going to do in-housing because we've done that quite well. It just seems a bit strange. That's all.
I completely agree with you on multiple things there. Kind of, if I were to see the likes of Unilever or P&G going down that route, I would say they would do it from a kind of incubator. We'll help the challenger brands do it. But then... What can a challenger brand, that's kind of an early stage challenger brand, learn from a massive multi-conglomerate FMCG? Probably not a lot in terms of how they in-house and how they manage their media internally, because they're both completely different beasts, despite the fact they're selling similar products. So then I find it even weirder that lastminute.com are going to be consulting with FMCGs, because travel, famously, you know, very low margin, acquisition-based, is a performance model. Yeah. FMCGs... not that at all. They are trying to increase brand awareness through whatever means possible. Yeah. An in-housing strategy surely has to be very, very different if you're looking at it from a performance perspective to a branding perspective. So again, it feels weird to me that they're using their own internal nous that they've learned through their own in-housing strategy to inform FMCGs how to do the same.
So I think we're taking this too literally.
Potentially.
I reckon what they're really doing, and if they are, I hope they are doing this because this would be the smart move, is that these brands that they work with are already buying on lastminute.com, right? So it's a case of how do you spend money in things like branding. Like, so, okay, they do loads of Facebook and Google because that's easy, right? So maybe lastminute.com is saying, look, we can help you with video buying, right? The reach and frequency on a digital, right? So if I was last minute, I would take that in-house specialism and actually aggregate those brands and act almost like a buying seat for them. And I think that's probably what they're doing. So
because they do already have another sidearm, platform that they can run, that other travel brands can run their activity from.
I guarantee that's what's happening. If you think about in-housing as a thing, as a trend, right? It's not specifically like I'll take everything in-house, right? Most agencies now, holding groups have people working with the brands on site and helping them with certain functionality, right? And then the rest of it's done through a trade desk or an app nexus or whatever. So technology is licensed by the client, and then the execution is done by the thing. So maybe this is this hybrid model that they built themselves. Some of their clients go, yes, I'd love to do more of this. Can you show us how? And then they go, but can you also do it for us? So like, if you think about it, it's a classic sort of almost like a meta agency or even a sort of aggregation ad network type player, right? So, you know, to buy at scale, last minute could do that, do all the PMPs and all the video and all the rest of it and help those smaller clients basically execute.
So they're advising their clients on strategy.
Yeah, and probably helping them with execution as well.
Brand new, like,
no, it's
all
not.
Businesses no. pretty much. Do so that, especially going through digital transformation, which in-housing very much is one of those things. It's confusing. It's not binary. There's a spectrum. Where do you sit? What are you trying to achieve from it ultimately? Like, that's the thing about in-housing that I think there's just like this whole new market has sprung up from in-housing, like the consultancy firms, these guys trying to do it. You're just advising on strategy at the end of the day. Like, what are you trying to achieve? What's your long-term goal? How are you going to get there? We can work with you as a partner to go do that.
But a lot of those consultancies end up start doing execution. What I've seen is that brands are going, oh, thank you. Can you help us do it? Because we don't have the capabilities. And like, we don't want to hire a full-time trader. Can you help us do it? So that's what, that's, it's weird. It's like reinventing the wheel. It's almost like, oh shit, that's kind of what an agency does, or that's what an ad network does. I'm going, we're going to go around in circles a little bit. I understand this is all driven by getting more insight and more sort of transparency and owning. I can understand a brand wanting to own a relationship with a tech execution layer like the trade desk. I can understand that. That makes a ton of sense, right? I can understand them wanting to own the data management activation layer, which is the DMP or CDP or whatever you're using, because it's their first party data. I can understand that. The execution piece is starting to get complicated, because then it's like the brand says, I need to hire really, really good traders. Like, let's be honest with you. If I was a trader, I'm not going to go out to West London and some garage in Hounslow to work for some brand. I'm going to work in the city working for a big holding group or Google or Facebook or whoever, or MeetIQ or Captify, whatever, one of these, or the Trade Desk, you know, one of these glamorous companies.
Are they in a garage in Hounslow?
Who?
Lastminute.com?
No, not them, a brand.
But I'm a brand. A generic brand.
A generic brand.
On the M4 corridor.
Yeah. Yes. Outside the congestion zone.
Terry's Tires, you know, for all your needs, all your travel needs.
But I mean, Anna, obviously the Trade Desk works with a lot of agencies and also brands through through various stages of this digital transformation we keep talking about, and the in-housing. And as you said, you know, in-housing is not binary, and actually you can't define in-housing as it's either this or this. It's just not that case, and everyone has their own versions of in-housing. Even Last Minute, all of their ATL stuff is still run by an agency, and their below-the-line stuff is run internally now. That's the choice they've made. There are many brands out there that do the same, have the same approach, and use agencies for TV buying, radio buying, everything else.
At home.
Exactly. But like, what are you seeing in terms of, are you starting to see at the Trade Desk a lot more brands want to take control of the licensing agreements and the contracts with the tech layer?
Yeah, and it's pretty bizarre for us as an agency first business to be having those conversations. We make sure that we always do it in conjunction with the agency partner in a record. But yes, we have had many, many brands come to us and either want to have visibility on the contract or a three-way contract or just transparency around what does that look like, ownership of data conversations, things like that. That's important. And, you know, so we're learning how to go do that. And I think we've done a really good job there of not damaging our relationships that we have with agencies. They're evolving. How they fit into the execution layer, I don't think is going to go away. It will have to evolve. They're being more consultant than they've ever had to be before. But yeah, like, talking to brands is definitely something that we do. It's just never in isolation.
Mm.
which is a smart move to get the holding groups involved in that process, because going around their backs is, you know, can be detrimental.
Yeah, and many ad tech companies are.
Oh, they've fallen their own sword over that
doing
one.
That. Absolutely. Yeah, it causes massive friction. And in an industry where we're talking about transparency a lot, that's one of the key areas where people struggle with transparency, is actually just not having open, honest conversations about who should own the contract.
Yeah.
And who should be a party to that conversation.
Yeah.
Anyway, on to our next news. We couldn't have this episode of the Matic podcast and not talk about Seismic. And, you know, we're not going to delve into what's happened and why it's happened, because everyone is very aware of what's happened with Seismic and their unfortunate downfall. And, you know, you speak to people within Seismic and it really humanises the challenge that business is going through, when you realise there are real people and their kind of livelihoods and their careers potentially at stake here. And it's obviously very, very upsetting to hear of the news. However, what it has done, it's done a few things. It's brought a lot of the doom mongers out of the woodwork, out of the ad tech woodwork, as it always does. But it's also tried to kind of bring other people have come out and saying, no, there's still things to be positive about. And Kieran, an article you've written that went out yesterday.
Was that yesterday?
Well, as this is going out tomorrow, will be yesterday.
Oh, yeah, sorry.
In an article you wrote that went out yesterday. Let's just play along, people, eh?
Okay, sorry.
Yeah. You talk about the fact that you cannot compare a medium-sized ad tech business, ad-serving business, to a multi-billion-dollar global financial crisis.
I mean, that is utter bullshit, isn't it? Like, to kind of sit and write, someone actually sat and wrote several posts about how this is tantamount to the multi-billion collapse of the world financial ecosystem. Utter rubbish. There is a section of this business that loves to sort of just talk about how rubbish, or how the industry is falling apart and this is the start of it and all the rest of it, right? So there's one theme at the minute that's saying that, oh yeah, all these SSPs and DSPs are holding debt, right? And I'm gonna say, I've said in the piece that that's always been thus, right? Any intermediate working in ad tech, from the ad networks 1.0 back in the early 90s to the sort of sophisticated DSPs and SSPs now doing most of the transactional stuff and programmatic, I've always held debt. That's the that's not a problem. It's just, it's a fact of life. You're a middleman. You hold debt. My sort of argument is that Seismic was a decently sized ad server business with some really nice point solutions, and it got bought by a PE firm who just basically fucked it, right? Let's put it plainly. They looked to make a quick buck, and again, it goes back to our SaaS versus transactional model, right? Didn't understand the ad tech model and thought, oh, this is a SaaS business, I can make X amount of money, right? Projections are wrong. Then they bought like the worst ad tech company in the history of our industry, Rocket Fuel. And let's be honest,
which you've always been very, very fond.
I honestly think they're the worst company I've ever seen. And not because of the model, right? Because I love ad networks. If they'd stayed private, made loads of money, I have no problem with that for Rocket Fuel. They just brought their shit into the public, right? They basically destroyed billions of dollars of shareholder value when they went public with 60% margins and the flimsiest model that anybody could have disrupted. Anybody with a DSP seat, a bag of rebate money, could have disrupted Rocket Fuel, right? It wasn't a differentiated technology. And we later learned that they had no AI at all. They were just basically mixing and matching customer data. It was a shit show, right? They destroyed billions of dollars of value and then destroyed a company. Let's be honest, Rocket Fuel broke Seismic. $128 million they bought that company. The integrations I heard were horrendous. And then obviously Seismic then had to manage all of that supply debt. So Vector looked at one and going, I'm not having this. Took a loss in it. Sold it to Cerebrum. And they're just going to basically tear that company apart. They'll sell the ad server. We won't see Rocket Fuel again. We'll see. They'll sell the Seismic ad server business. Pier 39 for me is probably the pick of the whole lot because of contextual and the post-IPTP. I think someone was going to buy that for a song. I think that's where Cerebrum will make serious money. And they'll make their money back on this. But it's not the end of ad tech. And there's just a little bit of objectivity would be great.
We are not seeing ad tech Armageddon. No. It is consolidation, and this is what happens with consolidation. Sometimes it's acquisitions, sometimes it's the death of businesses. It's sad to see, and yeah, people will jump on it as like doom and gloom, like you say, but ultimately this is consolidation. This has been predicted. The Lumascape has been a mess.
Yeah.
It's whittling down to the people that are really truly adding value in that supply chain.
Yeah.
And we talk a lot about, you know, the death of Seismic, is if you want to refer to it as the death of Seismic. You know, they were one of the biggest contenders in the ad serving business to Google. And that's why this is such a scary thing, because they were the Google competitor when it came to ad serving. But that doesn't. But they're still, compared to Google, a small to mid-sized ad tech company. They're not, just because they are the next thing to Google when it comes to ad serving doesn't mean they're in anywhere near, shape or form near Google when it comes to size and scale, right? Yeah. So actually, yes, okay, they were big in that one area, but ad serving, some argue it's the lifeblood of ad, of the supply chain. Others might say,
but it's Google have commoditized that business. Well, they've effectively give away for free, and and I think that the MediaMind / Seismic, as well, was MediaMind before it was Seismic, was a good counterweight, global counterweight, and a lot of the holding groups like to have something other than Google, right? And it worked pretty well, and they had some good like there's some great people at Seismic, by the way. It's very sad for them, particularly, you know, it's all well and good sort of castigating the company, but it was a pretty decent company, and it had good people, and it's pretty sad to see the situation, because people are going to lose their jobs, and it's not a nice situation to be in at all. But I think the fact that this is, let's take it into perspective, this is not like, this is not like a sort of a Bear Stearns or moment. Like this is a small, medium sized ad tech company, and they owe quite a bit of debt around the place, because that's what happens. But the people who are going to end up going to shoulder most of that debt is going to be the publishers, right? Because the SSPs have probably got clause in their contract saying you take responsibility in the event of a collapse and the whole thing. So they're the people who suffer in the end. In this whole sort of sorry saga,
and the ones that can't really afford to suffer.
And I don't think this business is going to go to Google. There's plenty of good. There's plenty of good businesses, like the Trade Desk, and
plenty of good businesses.
Seismic was often considered as the alternative to Google for those who didn't want to put all their eggs in a Google basket. They would choose the likes of Seismic. So actually, will they then go and choose other independent ad tech as a alternative?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I don't know. I don't know if that the Trade Desk has pivoted into the ad server business, but there's plenty of alternatives like Flash Talking and Adform have just done a P round, so there's no doubt they are trying to suck up that business, and that would be decent business. So it's not all tears. There's a bit of sunshine and
it's the and Terry Kawaja just recently come out with the kind of the Q1 Luma report and said there's a lot of stuff going on, there's a lot of negativity, but actually from an M&A perspective and from a billings perspective and ad spend perspective, Q1's been pretty good. We're starting off 2019 well.
Yeah.
Should we actually just try and bring some positivity back into our industry?
Think about GDPR a year ago. That was going to blow up the whole industry.
Absolutely.
Didn't happen. Same thing.
Although Google could blow us all up in a month's time with the ITP stuff. Who knows what's going to happen there? But that's another sort of storm in a teacup.
But then again, that will not be death. That'll be evolution.
No,
cookies. Legacy.
Yeah, let's look.
ID exactly. Is the future.
Exactly.
Quite.
We need to move beyond the cookie anyway. So all of this stuff is good for ad tech. I think, rightly so, there's going to be, should be consolidation. There's too many people in the middle. We could have three global DSPs, a couple of global SSPs, then some specialists in the middle as well, those native and all the rest, or localized players, which I think is what, you can't have 25 different SSPs doing the same thing globally. It's just not like, that's where
the
trouble starts.
That creates bad behavior.
Yeah.
And intransparency. Yeah.
With a lot of tech is starting to become commoditized, right? Particularly in display, right? Obviously, there's still loads of interesting spots like connected TV, out of home, like that haven't really been sort of tapped up yet. And that's where all that sort of innovation for me is happening, right? And mobile is still really, really interesting. So, there's a ton of stuff that bigger players will have the budgets to spend in R&D. Like, I know that the Trade Desk are massive. Their CEO effectively is the greatest product man in the industry. He lives and breathes that product, hence the reason why their UI is probably one of the best in the industry. So, there's companies that actually are dedicated to building specific product for real problems in the industry. And like, if you look at the landscape, you can argue the display is more or less sort of signed, sealed, and delivered, right? Banner display. You've got Google, Facebook, and then 20%ers, and we kind of take a break. The real interesting stuff is in video, connected TV, out of home, mobile. This is where the real interesting stuff's going to happen. And those
areas,
other channels,
areas that Google, for example, are struggling to get into, because
like,
the
TV people
existing
do not,
players do not want them involved.
No, TV people do not want Google involved, or Facebook, or to a certain extent Amazon, but they're wary of them. Like, so this is good for our industry, because if ad tech can build independent players in that space, it will thrive and survive. It's just at the minute, it feels that we've kind of got addicted to the double-click cookie over the last 20 years, and now we're saying, I have to kick my my crack habit, put the crack pipe down, you know, if you will.
That's a great way of putting it.
But yeah, you're right. There's so much opportunity still in the market. Yeah. Like CTV, huge. And then there's also other markets that haven't been 100%. Tapped up, like China, for instance.
I mean, the big enchilada.
This ties in very well to what we're going to talk about with Hannah and the trade desk. It's almost like it was scripted. I trust it wasn't. I mean, CTV, we talk about emerging channels, and the trade desk are massive proponents of connected TV. We had Jeff Green chat on stage with Kieran at ATS Singapore last year.
Great chat.
You know, saying CTV and actually APAC, they're the future of the industry, and there's a lot to be said for that. You know, what are you seeing in terms of the CTV market at the moment? We had you on stage last year at ATS London, Anna, talking about CTV, and it feels like there's still some way to go before it can be embraced, before advertisers even really understand what CTV actually is. What steps are the trade desk taking, and how are you seeing this moving?
I think there's ultimately a bit of a difference in what we've seen with like the display side of our business, the legacy part, in that there was the balance of power was more on the buy side, and that is different within the CTV space. So we have a job to do here with educating broadcasters and making them feel comfortable that the direction of travel is towards programmatic, and that this is where the revenue will come from, maybe not this year, but in years to come. Because ultimately for advertisers, CTV allows you to get that amazing format of a television, but applying your data holistically across all of your media channels, and understand your consumers better. And so there's just a ton of benefits for advertisers, and ultimately that's therefore where the revenue is going to flow towards. So it's on us to go and help hold hands with the broadcasters and make them feel comfortable that there's nothing bad about the direction of travel, but there is change afoot.
And is it them that have the power ultimately to be able to help advertisers understand where they can go when it comes to kind of the future of TV? I mean, we speak to a lot of brands, and frankly, they haven't got a bloody clue about what CTV is. And it's not their fault, really. They've got jobs to do. They have day jobs, and CTV isn't their day job. And actually, there's always sort of bluster happening around them. And they'll go, OK, I'll cross that bridge when I come to it. Like, it's not a big thing for me at the moment. But then when you have a conversation about this is the next thing for you, you know, you can turn your kind of linear TV buying into something quite special and integrate your digital and your linear channels together. They will then be rather screwed when it comes around to it, because they won't actually know what it is, and they all believe that CTV still is just linear TV buying through a digital platform.
It allows you to curate what you're buying. The CPMs, for instance, might actually go up. So yes, that's a good thing for the broadcasters. But if it allows you to eliminate wastage because you're being more targeted with how you're buying, it may also help inform, and this is how we're sort of thinking about it more, is that you may still buy 100% of what you were originally going to buy through like a linear buy with TV, but it might then be able to inform the rest of your buys across other channels based on like more holistic frequency caps. And that's like really interesting.
The other thing that would probably encourage the broadcasters is that if you can make this a bit more open, your sort of addressable market increases, because obviously, the power like TV has a powerful impact on brand impact and actually sales as well. So, you know, at the minute, you could say there's a finite number of advertisers that true linear, right? You know, they use big agencies. But imagine if you could democratize the buying access, particularly with ITV.
Why would you want to create friction
But make it easier for mid-sized market guys to go and build creative and then execute it through a programmatic platform. I mean, you have to be encouraged by the recent move by ITV working with Amobi or Videology to build out their own sort of programmatic layer. I mean, that must be a good start. Potentially ITV, the biggest sort of broadcaster and probably supply of ad inventory in the UK has taken that step.
Yeah, I mean, it's programmatic is real. They're taking it seriously. They're getting there. And then I think opening it up, like you say, creating less friction for buyers, that's like phase two for sure.
Okay. And I mean, so what do you think? We talked about connectivity. We talked about cross-platform. TV is at the next stage of a marketer understanding how they can really achieve cross-platform advertising? Is omnichannel finally going to be here? And is CTV the way to bring it together?
Because it's always been, and still is to today, like the largest portion of where advertising budget goes. So if you meaningfully start to move that over, that is true omnichannel for sure.
Interesting. I want to talk about kind of the other area that Trade Desk are very, very vocal in outside of APAC, which we'll get to, which is the AI piece. And obviously you launched your new platform kind of about a year ago, maybe sort of 10 months ago, that was built around AI.
Are you finding, Singapore.
It was at ATS Singapore. Yeah. Kieran actually introduced the launch.
I did.
In the global webinar.
It was great.
Yeah.
It was very good.
Exciting.
It's very, very glitzy.
It certainly was. Yeah. I mean, AI is such a buzzword in the industry, and people just hear the word AI now and they go, I can't listen to this crap again. I'm just done with that word. Are you finding that you're having to use AI alongside other terminology to get marketers and agencies to fully embrace
it? Personally, I also feel the same reaction about AI. However, that's why we talk about like what the product is and what the product benefits are. Ultimately, it's about distilling tons and tons of data. If you've got a lot of data, which most marketers have access to now or should have, how do you actually manipulate that data in a way that is then useful? And that's essentially what Koa, the product that we have, which is AI-led, allows marketers to do, and to make optimization decisions, to make budget allocation decisions, to make channel decisions around allocation. That's what it does. And those are the benefits, that it takes that grunt work out of loads and loads of analysis and does it all for you. Super smart.
Do you find, this question I have as a former media buyer, do you find that media buyers that kind of, you know, are quite controlling and want to be able to know what they're bidding, when they're bidding, and how much they want to increase something by, that when they hear the term AI will come in and take over that job for you, you can get on with actually focusing on creativity and focusing on doing more things for your clients to help them achieve, you know, greater results? Do you think that they would be scared of AI coming in and doing their bids for them, and they can't see what the changes are and if they're actually going to work or not? Is that a concern of people?
Absolutely, which is why we've built the tools to demonstrate like a full change log of when you've made a change versus the machine's made a change, what the impact was on that. You have the ability to select which bits you put on auto optimizations and which you don't. And ultimately just give like a ton of transparency around that heavy lifting so that you can control which bits you do and don't want to do. And it's not just about creativity, but it's also about like that then allows them to focus more on what should their strategy be. How do you test out different hypotheses and use the machines to then do the heavy lifting on what works and what doesn't? And ideally do that without spending budget as well. So that's where our planning tool comes into as well.
And tools like this will help, particularly, and you said it earlier, Anna, obviously you are an agency first, have always been an agency first business. Do you think that tools like Koa will actually help integrate and converge the planning and buying functions more than they probably have been in the past?
I think with programmatic, they've become quite divorced, and I think that's a shame. We definitely are seeing that sort of the communication lines are opening up back again. I think the growth of programmatic as a percentage of budget is also forcing that to happen. So planners are wanting to engage more. So yeah, it's a really interesting time. And agencies have got to, again, like, I know that they're pretty fed up, I'm sure, in agency land of reorganizing their structure of their businesses, but it's something that
every
they have to
minutes.
Do every few months to basically better cater to their clients' needs and what's going on in the market.
Interesting, very interesting. Now I want to talk about China. China is big for you guys.
Yeah.
Obviously, you've made some
everybody.
Well, absolutely. But the Trade Desk have made some kind of big, bold statements in terms of its kind of statement of intent to actually target China, and China being the next big opportunity. Why? What are you seeing in China? What is the big thing for that market for you guys?
Yeah, I mean, the size of the internet population is double that of the US. And you think about the US market as it stands today in terms of the revenue globally from an advertising perspective, it's huge still. But the growth within China and of the middle class in particular is like three times the speed of any other region. So the growth opportunity is not just exciting for us as a business, which is why we're going into there, but we want to help our clients, the non-Chinese brands that we work with, go into that market because we see it as a huge opportunity for growth for them ultimately.
And when people think of China, they think of barriers to market entry. Like, you know, for the Trade Desk as an American US business, how did you how easy was it for you to kind of enter that market and grow and expand as well as you have, and obviously gain their trust as an outside organization?
Yeah, it wasn't easy.
I'm sure.
It's taken 3 years to get wow. to this place. You know, regardless of all the groundwork over the last 10 years that the Trade Desk has done around building out a, you know, kick-ass product. But yeah, Jeff went and moved there for half a year to build that, those relationships and get that buy-in from the senior, especially from an inventory perspective, those executive relationships, the data partners to go and execute well. And, you know, now we, as a trusted partner for these, for the brands that we work with outside of China, we are someone that will help them go into that market as a trusted relationship, and we'll help them navigate through that, because otherwise it could be a huge time suck for a brand going into there without that support.
And what can, you know, what are the opportunities for the brands you work with going into that market? Kind of what does China offer them that the rest of the world can't, and how can the traders help them achieve that?
Phenomenal growth.
Right.
Yeah. And, you know, I think most CMOs are going to have some kind of target in terms of growth on their heads. China's a really, really great way to do that.
I think you took the right approach in China. You often see like Western companies going in and trying to compete with the local brands. Every ad network's a DSP, and every DSP is an ad network. So it's like, you know, you bringing new money to the table is a smart move, because that's what the local Chinese media companies want, bringing in new spend. So actually, the Trade Desk being a bridge to access the Chinese market is smart. Because I think anybody trying to compete in the domestic market it's a mistake, because it's very, very difficult and very entrenched. And obviously, like, some of the exchanges actually have their own DSPs and they'd see you as a threat. So, but if you bring new money to the table, then
yeah, the Chinese are definitely going to be able to get in there otherwise.
Is there an opportunity as well for you guys to work with local brands as well who want, like, for instance, if you see, you know, Facebook's revenue is, I think, 12-13% was all Chinese gaming companies. So is there a flip opportunity as well, where you can go to local brands going, we'll help you buy outside of China?
That's not our approach today. Very right. much the focus is, like you say,
China in,
bringing
as opposed
incremental
China
revenue
yeah.
from outside of China into China.
Right.
And China is a fascinating market in that the consumerism of the market is completely different from kind of what anybody in the West would know and understand. The way that they use data, the way they understand data, and the understanding of the value exchange is also completely different for an Asian consumer versus a Western consumer. How will that take some doing and some understanding for brands that aren't in China, that are looking to get into China, to understand how they can target their consumers?
Yes. So there is so much that we're learning about as a business, about Chinese consumers and how they interact and on the internet, and, you know, just even how pages look on the web.
They're
in
mental.
China. Yeah, they're completely yeah. different. And like you say, that value exchange is better understood over there. So I think something that we've always talked about is leveraging data, you know, to do smarter, better advertising. And I think the data element in China is there, and we really, really want to push that hard, because we think it'll make not only like good growth opportunity from accessing that audience, but doing it really, really effectively using data. So that's definitely something that we're trying to educate and push on.
Interesting. It's the one market where if the product's free, you're the product. That terrifies us in the West, but in China they go, yeah, we know, that's fine.
Yeah.
Yeah, fascinating. Anyway, on that note, I'm going to say thank you very much, Anna, for joining us today.
Thank
fascinating
you,
chatting to you.
Thank you both.
Thank you, Kieran.
Thank you, Lindsay.
And thank you, everyone, for listening.
Thanks, Rodney.
Thanks, Rodders.